I got good news and I got bad news. Yes, there is a new small business loan program. No, it ain't going so good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 27th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I mean, I did kind of give it away up in the open, right? So let us just dive right in, shall we? Round two of the Paycheck Protection Program started accepting applications this morning. Marketplace's Justin Ho spent his day checking in with banks and with applicants.
About 15 minutes after the SBA's application window opened this morning, Bay State Savings Bank in Worcester, Massachusetts had 100 applications ready to go. Bank President Peter Alden said, compared to the first round of PPP loans, banks have had much clearer guidance from the SBA.
They're better prepared as we are better prepared. So hopefully the system will hold up with the volume that's going to happen.
But the system didn't hold up. Small banks across the country reported technical problems submitting loans to the SBA. At LaSalle State Bank in Illinois, Senior Loan Officer Chris Duncan says he got error messages all morning.
At the bottom of every screen, you have to hit save and next. When you would do that, the system would time out or you get the spinning wheel of death and get booted out eventually.
Duncan says because his bank was only submitting 25 applications, he and his colleagues had to enter all of the borrower information manually for each loan. Names, social security numbers, employer ID numbers, a bunch of yes or no checkboxes. He says the process is supposed to take 10 minutes per application.
Whereas now, maybe it takes you an hour.
Meanwhile, banks that were submitting 5,000 or more applications could submit all of the information at once with a single document. The Bank of Southern California in San Diego is only planning to submit 1,200 applications. Bank President Nathan Rogge says he's frustrated with the process.
I do think those mass uploads that came from the largest institutions are really bogging down the system.
At Thayer County Bank in Hebron, Nebraska, President Patrick Kenner says this is giving bigger banks an unfair advantage.
It's just real frustrating, you know, to be sitting here, got everything ready to go, and then we're just spinning our wheels. So,
JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo declined to comment for this story. The Small Business Administration hadn't replied to a request by deadline. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This just in from the No, Come On, Really? File. The Los Angeles Lakers, among the most profitable and valuable franchises in the National Basketball Association, got, and to be clear, have returned $4.5 million from the first round of the SBA loan program. Good for the Lakers for giving it back, but the news highlights one of the issues with the PPP, right? Companies that didn't need the money getting it, and companies that really did need it, not. Christina Stemble runs a company that needed and still needs a PPP loan. She's the founder and CEO of a company called Farm Girl Flowers. They do direct-to-consumer flower arrangements. Christina, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So first of all, does your experience with the second round match what we just heard from Justin in his spot? Are you having problems today?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely matches what he's talking about. It seems like they've just put more money into it without doing any of the safeguards that needed to happen to prevent what happened in the first round from happening in the second round.
Yeah. You did a video the other day. It was a straight-to-camera 26-ish minutes on YouTube thing. And the takeaway, and I think you actually used these words, the Paycheck Protection Program has failed us. Explain that.
Yeah, I think it's failed everybody. And it's not, you know, I think everybody wants to point fingers and you know, blame people. I think it's a failing all the way around, though. I mean, it's a failure from, you know, trying to roll it out too quickly without putting proper safeguards in place to ensure that it wouldn't be scammed because everything seems to be used inappropriately. But it also was a failing on the part of CEOs that didn't have enough integrity to know that this was not set up for them. And, you know, being able to figure out that if you, you know, classify all of your different locations as separate entities, then you can get it for all of them and get $20 million when there was supposed to be a cap. I mean, all of those things could have easily been prevented if there was just, you know, an ounce more wisdom put into it and thought put into it before it was ruled out.
Give me the quick and dirty on what happened that first day which is now like a month or whatever it was ago, when San Francisco, where you are headquartered and did a lot of your sourcing, when they basically said shelter in place. What happened to your company?
Yeah, within 12 and a half hours, we had to shut everything down in San Francisco, which was where 85 to 90% of all of our orders came from. We already had hundreds of thousands of dollars of flowers on their way to us. And with only 12 hours to shut down a whole facility, you know, we had to throw out $150,000 worth of flowers. We had to furlough almost 200 people. And then I had to figure out very quickly how to pivot, because as a bootstrapped company, we only had 8 weeks of runway. Because we have perishable products, we have tiny margins. You know, this is not, I get a lot of feedback from people that are like, you know, that's irresponsible of you to have such little money in the bank. And it's like, okay, well, you come run a $50 million perishable product company and tell me how to do it, you know? And so that's, you know, how we had to close down was also really, really hard.
Walk me through the calendar here for a minute, would you? Mother's Day is around the corner. I imagine that is enormous for you. Are you going to be able to pay the bills, as it were?
Yeah, so Mother's Day, I feel like everybody in the floral industry has this big, like, ticking time bomb on our heads, because we have to get everything figured out by May 10th. This holiday gets us through the very slow summer months to fall, when it tends to rebound. Who knows what's going to happen this year with the economy? But we have, you know, 1 month that gets us through the next 4 months. And so if we can't figure out how to create supply, and we can't do it in San Francisco now, we've had to open actually 5 different distribution and fulfillment centers in a span of 5 weeks, which is about killed us.
Yeah.
But just in order to try to figure out how we can make enough orders for the demand, which will allow us the revenue to hopefully get us through the summer, especially since we didn't get the PPP loan, we don't have any safety net whatsoever. So without Mother's Day, we may not make it till the end of the year.
Well, so let's keep going with that, unpleasant as it may be. Do you think this crisis and the inability of the government to get money to enough companies that need it will cost you your company?
I'm hoping not. I'm hoping that I can, even without this, that would be so helpful and allow me to sleep more than 3 hours a night. Would, you know, it would have been really, really wonderful. But I'm hoping that I'm strong enough as a CEO and a leader of this company, and that I can, and creative enough that I can figure out other ways. You know, I'm probably on my 18th pivot by now. I don't know. I mean, the uncertainty with the, you know, economy is the thing that I just, you know, I can do all the financial models in the world, and that's what I'm doing up at night to make myself feel better. But, and, you know, I don't know what type of recession we may be going into, and that there's so much out of my control that I can't plan for, because I don't know what it is right now.
This is hard.
Yeah. It's really hard. Really hard.
Yeah. Christina Stembel, her company is called Farm Girl Flowers. Christina, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Wall Street on a Monday in the last week of April in the age of coronavirus. Everything's fine. Thanks for asking. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Chinese government said over the weekend, and yes, grain of salt with things the Chinese government says, but they said hospitals in Wuhan, where this whole thing started, don't have any coronavirus patients anymore, the latest possible indication that the crisis in China is fading. In Shanghai, that country's financial capital, people have officially been back at work for 10 weeks. So how's that coming along? Our China correspondent Jennifer Pack says signals are mixed.
My morning commute is not as lonely these days. More people are riding the bus, and once again, playing music or TV series from their smart tablets at full volume, like this man across the aisle from me. But then, a reminder that life is not back to normal just yet. A stiff April wind blasts through the bus. All the windows are open. Good ventilation will prevent the spread of the COVID-19 virus, says the government. So I've been sitting in icy offices, restaurants, and buses without heating all through the wet and chilly winter. Inside malls, office blocks, and on public transport, face masks are still a must, though fever checks at the entrances have gone from about half a dozen a day to sometimes none. And social distancing in parts of Shanghai, that seems like a thing of the past. Retired men and women dance on a public square. It's how a lot of them who live in tiny apartments get their daily exercise. Restaurants, well, those still in business, have full patios on sunny weekends, though weekdays are still tough.
So I'm at a Thai restaurant for lunch, and the server just said if I thought the food was good, I should leave a good review on something similar to Yelp in China. It's called Dianping. And in exchange, he said I could get a free dessert.
Businesses can get punished if they don't screen for coronavirus carriers. Some depend on a health app that assigns residents a color QR code, green, yellow, or red. Mine's green, meaning I'm coronavirus free. The app says it uses government data to assess our health, but we're not told which data exactly. And not all places will accept the health QR code. An announcement on the Shanghai subway to scan a separate QR code every time you get on a train and input contact details, though registering is voluntary, for now. In theory, if you're not sick and you're okay to hand over a lot of personal information, you can travel freely around China, but not so for foreigners. The U.S. State Department has advised African Americans against visiting southern Guangzhou City after reports that black people there are being forced into quarantine even when they've tested negative for the coronavirus. China denies any racist policies, but its state-run media has focused on the fact that new coronavirus cases are mostly imported. And now that the pandemic is becoming worse abroad, foreigners, wherever they're from, have reported being turned away from restaurants, shops, and hotels. So before I came to this hotel in Shaoxing, a three-hour drive outside of Shanghai, I had to check, will the city allow me in? Will this hotel accept foreigners? Will I be allowed back into Shanghai without being quarantined? China has also shut its borders to outsiders. So even with a valid work visa, if I leave the country now, I won't be allowed back in. From Shanghai, where I'm staying put, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
There are some things about this pandemic that make total sense. Like, we need to test a lot and keep your distance, wash your hands, wear a mask as appropriate. Among the things that are less clear, what it takes to be an essential business, because it can be hard to tell. Pharmacies and grocery stores? Obviously, yeah. Drapery companies, though, or bicycle shops? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab checked in with some essential businesses about what they have learned while staying open.
Bob McNichols is happy the golf course where he works is considered essential. He still has a job, but he's not so thrilled about the word essential.
I regret in a way that the category itself was named essential businesses. And I understand that hospitals and other facilities are essential in a way that golf is not.
McNichols manages Longbow Golf Club in Mesa, Arizona. He says, look, he gets it. Of course people can live without golf, but it doesn't mean they should. And players have been coming.
You play against yourself and you play against the course and you might be playing with other people, but there's no need for physical contact.
Not all golf courses are open. In mid-March, the Department of Homeland Security outlined essential businesses, including industries like agriculture, construction, and energy. But ultimately, it's up to states and cities to decide.
Muddled and confused is how I would describe the reaction from small businesses.
Elizabeth Melito at the National Federation of Independent Business has spent the last month on the phone with business owners going over state mandates. She says some are written in clumsy legal jargon, and the reasoning behind a lot of the designations just doesn't make sense.
Why outdoor construction but not outdoor landscaping? That has added to the confusion and frustration.
Melito says the rules are only going to get more confusing as states restart their economies, because there won't be a mass reopening. It'll be a trickle. And local governments are, again, going to pick who can reopen and who can rehire workers.
There's a way, you know, to do it thoughtfully and safely, but we do need to plan to start reopening.
For those that can open, it won't be business as usual. So what will it look like? Jesse Jacobson owns Tonkadale Greenhouse in Minnetonka, Minnesota.
It's a lot of no's.
No bathrooms, no shopping in groups, no more of that free buttery popcorn the customers love.
You know, it's just opposite to what customer service is.
Because she could stay open, Jacobson was able to keep her staff on payroll. And her business is down just a bit. But the real test is coming. 40% of the store's sales happen in May.
All of our spring product is usually timed to be ready for Mother's Day, kind of what I like to call the big show.
Of course, lots of industries have their own versions of the big show in spring and summer. Whether they're able to take the stage, that's up to their local government. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not the best job market to come back to.
Yeah. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 358 today, 1.5%, closed to 24,133. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 95 points, about 1.1%, 8730 there. The S&P 500 picked up 41 points, 1.4%, finished at 28.78. More on that market and actual economy disconnect in just a couple of minutes. Best performing sector of the markets today, finance, don't you know? Goldman Sachs up 3.6% today. JPMorgan Chase gained 4.3%. Slump in oil meant another bad day across most of that industry. Marathon Oil down 1.6%. Apache Corporation shed 1.7%. U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate down 23% on the day. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I am not a betting man. More accurately, really, I'm just a terrible, terrible gambler. But I would offer you real money that come Wednesday in Jay Powell's post-Fed meeting press conference, he will have used the phrase the real economy not less than a half a dozen times. The real economy, of course, the one in which we all live and work and buy stuff, although those last two increasingly less, which gets me to the point. With the real economy so obviously in distress, what the what with the stock market right now? More than 26 million people have lost their jobs in the last 5 weeks, and yet the three major indices are up 20% or more in the same period. So we have called Anat Admati. She's a professor of finance and economics at Stanford, and we have asked her to talk about that disconnect. Professor Admati, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I laid out the numbers up there in the introduction of this piece. Small businesses and the real economy in this country are having a terrible time, and yet the stock market is well off its lows. What is going on?
Well, a few things are going on. The stock market is high because the stock market doesn't really represent the entire economy. If you look at even who owns it, but especially if you look at the policies that the federal government, the Fed, the Treasury are doing, they are propping up the stock market. This is from the playbook of the last financial crisis. There's a lot of also money slushing around the whole world, and it's finding its home in the U.S. stock market, which is propped up a lot by the Fed and the Treasury.
Let's get to the small business loan program, which I mentioned up at the top of the program. And as we were talking about before we turned the microphones on, you've got friends who are having some problems. I wonder if nobody who's actually investing in America today in the stock market understands the real issues of what is going on with small businesses, which drive so much of employment in this country.
Right. If you're just a stock investor, then you might actually not understand what's going on down on the ground in the economy. And small businesses actually have to survive somehow, and it's becoming incredibly difficult for them. Some businesses that are would be viable in regular time where people can come in, they can't even pay the rent or do anything. And so there are two sides to every transaction, but it's really deeply disturbing what's going on.
Isn't there something to be said for supporting the stock market? The idea of the wealth effect and the idea of people actually having investments and we want to maintain those?
Well, sure, the large corporations, you know, employ people and all of that. But the way they, even their own money is distributed goes mostly to investors and to executives, and et cetera, and doesn't necessarily trickle down to everybody else who depends on that corporation. So just maintaining the corporate entity without actually worrying about all the people in the country is not necessarily the way to support the economy.
Okay, so let's get metaphysical here for a second, and then I promise I'll let you go. Do you suppose this changes, this crisis changes market-based American capitalism?
I hope it does, but I think what will need to happen there is we would need to rethink a lot of places where we think that the market left alone is going to solve our problems. And that includes the way, you know, our financial system is structured, the way our healthcare system is structured. And so if we're rethinking capitalism, there's a lot to rethink, and I hope it does happen, but I'm not sure it will.
Anat Admati, she's a professor of finance and economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
People get relocated by their employers all the time, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes not so much. The 7,000 Peace Corps volunteers who were ordered home back in mid-March are definitely in that not-so-much category. And now, in an economy without a whole lot of momentum going for it, they are trying to find their footing. Marketplace's Andy Euler caught up with some of them.
It was just a month ago when 34-year-old Adam Greenberg and his partner were developing sustainable fish farms in Central Africa. Then, on March 16th, an email from the Peace Corps telling them to come home.
Quite frankly, after learning about the chaos of airports and how it was accelerating in the United States and the general unpreparedness that it looks like the United States was facing, we kind of thought, you know, we might actually be safer here in this rural village.
So they considered just staying in Zambia. That would have meant that they'd be completely on their own, no more pay, no health care, nothing. But that wasn't the deciding factor for Greenberg coming back to San Diego.
After a very lengthy discussion all day about this, we decided, you know, we wouldn't want to become a burden on Zambia's infrastructure. So we figured it would be the most responsible thing to return.
He can't wait to get back to Zambia, but the official word from the Peace Corps is it'll be at least until October before anyone can return to their service countries. He's got enough money saved up to be okay for a few months, but after that, he'll likely have to start looking for a temporary gig to pay the bills at a time when unemployment is all of a sudden jaw-droppingly high.
It's not the best job market to come back to.
23-year-old Stephanie Estrera was only 6 months from completing her two-year stint in Southeast Asia when she was sent back to the U.S. She went from spending her days teaching kids and mentoring local teachers in the Philippines to looking for work in Boise, Idaho.
I've also started researching just some local volunteer opportunities around the Boise area. So next steps is, it's all kind of up in the air, but I feel like it's like that for a lot of Americans.
Right now, she's living with her parents. Tim Fang is too, but it took a minute to line that up after he was forced to leave Thailand.
I came back to the United States, but both my parents are considered high risk, so I had to quarantine myself for 14 days in a rental property that I had to pay for up front.
He says the Peace Corps is working on reimbursing him for the rental, but paperwork is backed up. The Peace Corps also announced it would provide volunteers with a one-time $1,500 stipend to cover costs associated with the evacuations. That's on top of money volunteers normally get when they conclude their service. Like so many others, Feng would love to go back and finish up his service, but for now...
I spent the last couple of days kind of like reworking the resume, looking at different job opportunities, looking at a bunch of grad school opportunities. Seeing what's available out there is just really tough right now for a lot of people.
There's a network of former Peace Corps volunteers trying to help current volunteers when and where they can. Kate Raftery is Director of Service Innovation at the Peace Corps. She says some have offered places to stay, job opportunities, and emotional support because for the volunteers...
There is disappointment. There is regret. And I think probably the biggest one is just the unknown.
Raftery says they'll determine country by country when it's safe for volunteers to return. And a lot of that depends on when those countries open their borders and begin accepting foreigners again. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I'm not entirely sure how I feel. This was in The Verge on Friday. Microsoft has apparently settled the how many spaces after a period should you use debates. The company is updating Microsoft Word to flag two spaces after a period as an error and offer a correction to one. I don't know. What do you think? All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's up 358 today on the point scale, 1.5%. The NASDAQ up 95 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 picked up 41 points on the day, 1.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. And I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.